Coming up on this episode of Crime Family.
The police very heavily begin pushing their own narrative and their theory onto the suspects, and they heavily question Amanda about that text exchange between her and Patrick. They found a bloody fingerprint on a pillowcase that was underneath Meredith's dead body, and it was revealed that this fingerprint belonged to a man named Rudy Gaudet.
Rudy had even originally said that Amanda had nothing to do with it in his confession. So he said Amanda has nothing to do with the murder and that she wasn't even there that night. But as the police continued to question him, his story gradually changed to involve Amanda.
And obviously, they didn't do a big enough search in the first initial day that they did search it. 46 days later seems way too long for something to be found like that, especially something that significant.
Everyone, welcome to Crime Family. I'm your co-host Katie, and I'm here with my siblings AJ and Steph. And today we are on to part two of our Meredith Kircher murder case. So if you haven't already, go back and listen to part one as we kind of get into the background and some of the evidence surrounding this case. And today we're going to get into the arrests of Amanda Knox, Raffaele, and some other people that we'll get into. So we got a lot to go over, so get ready.
Yeah, so we've kind of set the stage so far of what the crime scene looked like and Amanda's account of that morning, because she was the first one to kind of enter that apartment after the murders had taken place. So as we've mentioned a little bit in the last one, the police really were focusing in on Amanda Knox and her boyfriend, Raffaele Sollecito, very early on, and they began formulating a theory that they think happened in order to explain Meredith's murder. So upon a search of Amanda's phone records, they discover a text exchange between Amanda and her boss, Patrick Lumumba, from the night of November 1st. Now remember, Amanda worked at Le Chic, the restaurant, and Patrick owned that bar, and Amanda worked for him. The text exchange that the police discover on November 1st interests them because of the conversation that they have, which leads police to believe that Amanda and Patrick potentially had both been involved in Meredith Kircher's murder together. So Patrick texted Amanda, who was originally scheduled to work the evening of November 1st, and told her not to come into work because it was very slow and they don't need her. Remember, November 1st was a holiday. I believe it was a Monday and it was a holiday. So just a very slow day at the bar in general. So he said, you know, don't bother coming in. And then Amanda texted back, quote, see you later, end quote, which she wrote it in Italian, but that's kind of the translation there. In her mind, saying see you later meant like, you know, see you around. But the police thought that it could prove that the two might have had plans later that night to meet up. And maybe they did see each other the night of November 1st, when Amanda previously said that she was only with her boyfriend, Raffaele, that night. So Amanda explains, like in interviews since then, that the text was in Italian and she wasn't very good at Italian at this time. Remember, she's only been in Perugia for like maybe not even 2 months yet, or just 2 months. So she's not fluent by any means. So likely that it was just a poor translation. And so the meaning and context of see you later might have been sort of lost in translation. It might have been very different to her than what it literally meant on the text. Amanda and Raffaele, they're both brought in for questioning just days after Meredith's murder, and the police very heavily begin pushing their own narrative and their theory onto the suspects, and they heavily question Amanda about that text exchange between her and Patrick. And the police interrogation is intense, it's long, and it involves the police lying to both Amanda and Raffaele in hopes that they will eventually just end up confessing to the crime or telling them what they know. So for example, they actually lie to Amanda during interrogation by telling her that Raffaele had told police that Amanda wasn't with him at all that night. And obviously he didn't say that. He never said that, but that's what they were telling Amanda and making her believe that, oh, well, he's saying it wasn't true and kind of just putting that pressure on her. They also lied by saying that they already knew who the murderer was. They heavily implied that it was Patrick Lumumba and that she had been there with Patrick when he killed Meredith. So they interrogate her for hours. They don't give her any water. They don't give her a break. And they just continually lie to her and lie to her and yelling at her, and they're intimidating her and just basically confusing her and making her like confident that she is hiding something. And so to the point where she's second guessing where she was and who she was with that night. There's one point, I can't remember if it's the Megyn Kelly interview that I've been referencing or if it's another interview, but she does say in an interview that she recalls like during these interrogations, there was actually someone who came in and said that they were an interpreter, but she was actually a police officer. Amanda didn't know that at the time, but she's kind of saying that she is coming in to interpret. Because remember, Amanda's having these conversations in Italian at first. You know, she isn't fluent in the language. So you can imagine having an interrogation in general, but coupled with the fact if you don't know the language, it's very hard. So the interpreter comes in and tells her a story about her own life. So the interpreter goes and she says like, oh, I was involved in a terrible car accident a few years ago. And, you know, I have no recollection of any events that led up to that accident. I was just kind of driving along and all of a sudden I woke up in the hospital and I had lost all memory of the incident itself. So this interpreter was trying to, or this police officer really, was trying to convince Amanda that this is similar to what happened to her, that she had blocked out a terrible memory of Meredith's murder and that she does know what happened and that she was there, but she just needs to remember it right now. And if she doesn't remember it now, she'll not see her family again. So you can imagine, given this pressure and this threat of never seeing your family again, that you would probably even convince yourself that what she was saying was true and that she must know something. She's kind of racking her brain, being like, what do I know? Like, I'm maybe just so traumatized, it's blocked out of my memory. So when the police lie to her, they push her to certain conclusions, like eventually insinuating that she was there with Patrick when Patrick killed Meredith, hoping that she would give in and provide all this information to them that in the moment Amanda could believe is 100% true based on all of these lies that they've been given her, and then only realizing once the interrogation stops that all of what she had just said or anything she might have confessed to never actually happened and that the police had literally forced a false confession out of her. So that's wild to me that the police are able to even just do that. That they can bring in this person as a fake interpreter who's like trying to manipulate her basically into coming up with a false story. So Amanda explains in an interview with King 5 Seattle in December 2023 that the thing that bothers her the most about her case still to this day is the fact that once the police got the confession out of her, so Amanda does give a full confession after that interrogation saying that she was with Patrick when he killed Meredith. So that's all the police really need. You know, they take that and run with it. And so she says once they got that confession, it was 100% over for her, even if the forensic evidence completely exonerates her. And she says because there's such a lack of awareness in the general public about false confessions and how they're given, people just assume that if you confess, you must be guilty because no innocent person would implicate themselves if they were innocent, right? Like that's kind of, I think, the general consensus in the general population is, if you admit something, you're guilty. You're not going to falsely confess to something.
We've seen this in other cases where people falsely confess. And like in my mind, I'm still like, there's no way I would ever falsely confess. And everybody says that, but you have no idea of the stress and the pressure and maybe some of like the deceitful tactics they have on you while you're in there. So you can, as much as you want to say you would never false confess, like you just never know.
And also keep in mind that Amanda is at this point 20 years old, very young. And I think at that point, and even many people for when they're older, like you just assume that the police are on the up and up. You assume that they have the best of intentions. They want to find the killer. And if you're innocent of something, you're like, well, they're going to clear me because I'm not the one who did it. And they're really trying to find that person. So I think that naivete of not really knowing what the police were capable of. Also, she's in a foreign country. So I think, and she was young, so I think all of that coupled together, like she just thought the truth is going to come out eventually. And so, you know, and also you just beat someone down enough in that interrogation room and they're going to probably confess to things just to get it to stop.
And also none of her interrogation was like audio recorded or video taped. So I mean, it's really her word against theirs. So they could have said, done whatever they wanted to her in there. And I mean, she doesn't really have a leg to stand on. She doesn't really have anyone to back her up because there's no like evidence of it. And I've even heard her say in an interview before, like they even hit her, like trying to get her to say certain things. So, I mean, you have no idea what they were doing in there. And you might mention this later, but also like you were saying, they were talking in Italian and she wasn't understanding. And at one point she was just like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. And then one of the investigators was like, oh, I know what fuck is. He's like, fuck you too. So they were just like,
it was a mess.
Yeah. And so I can't imagine, can you imagine being in a foreign country and the cop is like yelling, fuck you at you? Like, it's just terrifying.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I can't imagine, like, what she was going through. She didn't have any family or friends, like, around, and she was in a foreign country. She didn't really speak the language, and in the back of her mind, she knows she didn't do it, but, like, she doesn't know what Raphael said. Like, she didn't talk to him, so it's, like, it's almost like in, like, a, I wouldn't say it's like a horror movie, but, like, it's just, like, you can't imagine what it's like until you're actually there. Like, I can't imagine, like, how she was feeling at the time. And it's so surreal to me that they use those tactics to this day, probably, too, to get confessions out of people, even though they didn't do it. Like, I mean, it brings me back to, like, this has nothing, like, we've never covered this case, Making a Murderer, where one of the suspects in that case was a young boy, and he was, like, they, like, made him confess, even though he didn't do it, because they were just, like, pressuring him and, like, calling him names and saying, like, you did this, and it's just, like, I can't imagine, like, that those things are still allowed to this day.
Yeah, and I mean, we've covered cases, like the Jeffrey Deskovic case. He gave a false confession under duress from the police officer and all their manipulation tactics. So it's just crazy. Like, could you imagine you're in 20 years old in a foreign country that you've just been there for like 2 months, and the police officers are telling you, oh, well, your boyfriend just said that you weren't with him that night, but you're saying that you are. So he's telling us that you weren't. So you weren't. And we also know that Patrick killed her, and we know that you were there that night. Here's the text. Like, we know that you did it. So just tell us. And then they're like giving her hints, and they're, like I said, not giving her a break. They're not giving her water. They're just beating her down mentally to the point where she's just, you're so like distraught. You're so under distress that you just want it to end. So you feel like if you give them what they want, they're going to stop. But I don't think you recognize the gravity of what that situation is going to turn into, because once they have that confession, it's very hard to come back from that. Because, like I said, the general consensus is no one's going to confess to something they didn't do, right? So once you give that confession, it's almost over for you. Also, Amanda says in an interview in December 2023, she says, like, the scary thing is as well that most people to this day do not know what actually goes on in an interrogation room. She says that we think we know because we've seen the movies, and we think that we can actually say what happens when someone's being interrogated. But in reality, the police are legally allowed to lie to you. They're allowed to manipulate you into confessing to something you've never done. And people assume the police are the good guys and that they're just doing their job. But I mean, beating someone down so badly to the point where they're confessing to things they never did is not what just doing their job is supposed to mean. It's outright tampering and manipulation that completely interferes with cases all the time, not just in this one.
And the police can also, like, threaten you with a harsher punishment. Like, if you don't confess now, then we're going to go for the death penalty. Or, you know, if you don't tell us now, you're never getting out of jail. And like you said, oh, you're never going to see your family again. But it's like, if you just tell us what happened, you know, we'll help you and there might be a chance for you, even though they really don't have any intention of doing any of that. But I mean, they're just allowed to say that kind of shit. So it's super scary.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like their mentality is just get the confession under any means necessary. So we'll lie, we'll promise you things that we're never going to do, we'll threaten you with things we're never going to do, but just kind of get that confession. So pretty wild to me. The main interrogation that proved detrimental to Amanda's case, the one where she gives that confession that she was there with Patrick when he killed Meredith, it was done in the middle of the night. And Amanda actually has a good explanation why she thinks this was the case as well, because she says that the Italian police knew that Amanda's mother was on an overnight flight on her way to Italy at that very moment to support Amanda. And the police must have known that once Amanda's mother was there, it's going to be very difficult to manipulate her. And maybe this is really their last chance of getting Amanda to crack before her mother shows up. So that's why they chose to do this interrogation in the middle of the night. I mean, probably for other reasons too, so that she would just be so tired and drained. But that obviously probably played a big part. And mind you, there's no lawyer present for any of this. Like, there's no lawyer in the room. She wasn't given any lawyer or legal representation. So that was a big part of it as well.
I wonder if in Italy, if Miranda rights are even a thing. That's probably just a North American thing, do you think? Like, do you think they would say that you have the right to a lawyer and stuff like that there?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. That's a good point.
I was just actually going to, like, say that. I was, like, I was wondering the same thing. Like, they have Miranda rights because... To me, it sounds like they don't. If she didn't have a lawyer or she wasn't read her rights, like, she would never know. Like, she's never been arrested in her life or done anything criminal. She would never know. So, yeah, maybe that's something we can look up. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, and I think kind of going back to what I said before, like, she's also 20 years old at this time. She's probably not going to be even have the foresight or think about, oh, I should ask for a lawyer. Like, you're just... kind of in an innocent sort of mindset at that time, and you're not really thinking of that. And again, you probably think, oh, well, the police are the good guys. They're going to get to the bottom of this. They're going to interview me, and then they'll let me go because they'll know that I'm innocent, right? So I think you don't even think to ask for your lawyer to be present until it's already too late, and you've already said things you shouldn't have probably. So eventually, in that confession, she tells the police that she let Patrick into the apartment that night and witnessed him sexually assaulting and killing Meredith. So that's what she says in this written confession. And they even had Amanda convinced that she was so traumatized by what she witnessed Patrick do that she had just completely forgotten it. And I already mentioned, but Amanda had no lawyer present. She had no access to an interpreter for most of it and had to have these conversations with police in Italian. She wasn't fluent in Italian by any means, so you can imagine the miscommunication and poorly translated explanations that Amanda was providing. And like Katie said before, like, she was saying, I don't know what the fuck's happening. And then they misconstrue that. It's just a total mess. By the time Amanda comes to realize what she had already done and she's given this confession, it's already over because the police now had this signed paper by her that explicitly said that her boss, Patrick Lumumba, killed and sexually assaulted Meredith. And she was there to witness it, saying that she was in the kitchen and she heard Meredith's screams as Patrick stabbed and killed her in the bedroom. Again, going back to the Megyn Kelly interview that I watched that she had with Amanda Knox. So Amanda actually explains in the podcast that she doesn't think the police at the very beginning necessarily thought she had done it. But she believes that because they misinterpreted her behavior, which was not looking concerned or shocked or anything, they assumed that because she had no real emotion, that she must know something. And even if she wasn't the one who killed Meredith or she wasn't there, but she must at least know maybe some valuable information. So at the very least, they probably thought that she was hiding something from them. To what level, they didn't know. But when they saw that text exchange between Patrick and Amanda, this is kind of all they needed to go on in order to craft this story of Patrick's guilt with Amanda as the accomplice. So once they had the signed statement from Amanda, Patrick was arrested and charged with Meredith's murder. And at the same time that this was happening, however, there were several people who were coming forward to provide and corroborate Patrick's alibi on the night of Meredith's murder. So during the time of Amanda's interrogations, she was being questioned for hours on end. And I don't know how far down the line it is, but at one point she is brought back to the crime scene and she's told to look through cutlery drawers for knives that could have been used in the murder, because obviously there was multiple stab wounds on Meredith's body. So the police were quite literally leading Amanda to tell them what they want her to tell them. And they're very openly coercing her to give in to this theory that they already have. So they said, oh, she killed her with a knife that was in the kitchen drawer. And so they're like leading her down this path to get her to provide that. But very quickly, the police's theory is falling apart because the man that was implicated in Amanda's sworn confession was being cleared because the police were able to confirm that Patrick was at his bar the night of the murders. And I think it's a Swiss man actually came forward and said that he spoke with Patrick at the bar at the time when he should have been at Amanda's apartment killing Meredith. Even though people were coming forward and Patrick was basically cleared and his alibi was corroborated, Patrick was still held in jail for 2 weeks before being released, even though they knew that he was cleared. Kind of sad that, like, Patrick eventually goes on to lose his bar due to his wrongful involvement in the case. And he eventually, you know, moves out of Italy and moves to Poland with his wife after he's released. So it's just sad kind of he got wrapped up and thrown into all of this. And, you know, just know that at one point he was in jail for 2 weeks. And it was out there in the media that he had killed Meredith in collaboration with Amanda. So his reputation was basically tarnished. And So he had to basically move out of the country to avoid that. And to this day, he still holds Amanda responsible for this disruption in his life, for making her false confession against him. However, Amanda claims that his anger is kind of misdirected because she's coerced into that confession by the police. Like, it's very likely that the police would have been perfectly happy with Patrick sitting in prison for the rest of his life if his alibi didn't come forward. That was just an inconvenient thing that happened, was that people were corroborating his story. So it's definitely strange that he would direct his anger towards Amanda and not to the Italian police. So that's just weird. I guess he still has the thing of, like, you're not going to confess to something that you didn't do. So he blames her for confessing. But there was a lot of different factors in there in this story. So just ultimately really sad, too, that Patrick Lumumba was kind of implicated. So what do you guys have thought about, like, that part, like his kind of anger towards Amanda?
I kind of get why he's angry, because it kind of sounds like to him that she ruined his life by, like, saying that he was there. But I also kind of get where Amanda's coming from. Like, it wasn't her initially thinking that he did it. It was the police saying that he did it, and she just confessing to the fact that he did it. But, like, I just feel bad for him because his life is, like, uprooted and turned around, and he had to move and whatever. But Amanda's life also changed, too. It's not like she is, like, laughing, saying, haha, like, you did it. Her life is changing, and she was also pressured into confessing. So I kind of can see both sides of why he's angry and why she might be angry at him and stuff like that. So it's really hard to pick a side, I guess. But
yeah, I can definitely see why in the beginning he'd be super pissed. I'd be like, why are you dragging my name into this? Like, I had nothing to do with it. But it really, like, it's not like she brought him up from the beginning. Like we said, it was the Italian police, and she just kind of ran with it. And like Steph was saying, it's not just like she's saying he did it and she had nothing to do with it. Like, she, her own name got dragged in there, and so she kind of dragged herself down as well in it. So you can kind of see that she, that really wasn't her intention. So I can see why he's mad at the beginning, but even still today, after he knows everything that went down, he'd have some forgiveness. But I don't know, I'm not them. So
yeah, so yeah, like, while I can understand his anger, but it's like, it is misdirected. I think if you're going to be angry at anyone, it really should be the police, because they're the ones who really are at fault, as we've explained.
Also, something that's super unfortunate too, I've heard multiple sources that Amanda, like, her mom came to pick her, her mom came to Italy and told her to, like, come back to the U.S. with her. Like, she wasn't, like, she was fleeing, but she was allowed to leave the country because she wasn't under arrest at this moment. But she was kind of like, no, I want to stay and help the police figure out what happened. I don't know. I feel like, I don't know when the timing of this was, because you'd feel like after that big interrogation, she'd definitely be like, I'm getting out of here. So it must have been before that. I think it was. I think it was before she had this big interrogation with the police. She had the option to just leave and get out of there, but she wanted to stay and help. And that, because of that decision, kind of this whole thing, she got wrapped up in all of it, when she could have just left and maybe never have been forced to go back. So that was like a huge, like a little decision, I think, that ended up with huge consequences.
I mean, and I think if she did go back home, like, people would have probably thought, like, oh, she's fleeing the country. Like, this is sketch. I feel like they would have flipped everything that she did at that point.
But she wouldn't have been in that interrogation room with just the police, and she wouldn't have had that false confession. And so it would have really obviously changed the whole outcome for her if she did just leave. Even though it would have looked bad for her, like, it would have ended up a lot better, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it would look bad for her, but not as bad as a false confession looks like, or not as bad as a confession.
Yeah, that's the worst look.
So once it became clear that Patrick Lumumba had no involvement in Meredith Kircher's murder, the police needed to build a new theory. So they release Patrick, and this new theory, again, Amanda is at the center of it all. The same day that Amanda and Patrick are arrested, Amanda writes a note and presents it to the police, which informs them that she was recanting her previous statements and that the confession she gave was given under duress and extreme pressure by the police. So this note that she wrote was eventually released to the media on November 22nd, which is only like 20 days after the murder, so we're still very early on. But not many people in the public or the media believed at that time anything that Amanda was saying. You know, in the eyes of them, she was someone who had confessed to what she did. And Italian law enforcement and the media had already begun their slander campaign against her. And the way that they twisted it in the media was they painted her as this sex-crazed woman who was evil and dangerous, and that she had killed Meredith during a violent sex game gone wrong. And so we'll get into the media portrayal of Amanda a bit later on. But really, no one believed anything she was saying after she gave that confession. And in that letter, she was kind of exposing what the police had subjected her to, but it kind of fell on deaf ears. And like I said, even with the recanted confession, Patrick Lumumba still was held in custody for those 2 weeks. When they knew that A, that she recanted it, and B, that there was all these other witnesses coming up with his alibis and that were corroborated. So it's just kind of sketchy all around on their part. And while this was all happening with Amanda and Patrick, police investigators had discovered new evidence at the crime scene. They found a bloody fingerprint on a pillowcase that was underneath Meredith's dead body. And it was revealed that this fingerprint belonged to a man named Rudy Gaudet. And he was a man originally from the Ivory Coast who was living in Perugia, Italy, since the age of 5. So Rudy had a lengthy criminal record and he was known to police. He had a history of violence and robbery. And the fact that his fingerprint was on this pillowcase and other pieces of critical evidence, like Meredith's bra, a sweater of hers, and on Meredith's body, was enough for police to determine that he was, of course, involved in some way. So the police tracked down where Rudy was living, and they raided his apartment. And Rudy wasn't there when they raided his apartment, but they take DNA from his toothbrush, and they test it against the DNA and fingerprints found at the scene, and it's, of course, a match. So by the time they do all of this, it's been days after the murder, and Rudy has already fled the country and gone to Germany. So Rudy was actually caught just weeks later by German police after being caught on a train without a ticket. And then once they caught him, he was extradited back to Italy to face charges for the murder and sexual assault of Meredith. So they have this guy in custody now who has DNA evidence that he was there at the scene. And Amanda actually says that it was an interesting timing because it was around the same time that they released Patrick that they came out with the news that they have this new man in custody, Rudy Gaudet. So it's almost like, you know, they were just kind of swapping it out. Like, okay, we had the wrong guy initially, but now this guy is the right guy. But also just because they had Rudy Gaudet in custody, that doesn't mean that they were just going to free Amanda or Raffaele, which you'd think, oh, they found the guy who has DNA at the scene. Shouldn't that be enough to show, like, there's nothing tying Amanda or Raffaele to the scene except this confession, which we know was bogus. Instead of clearing Amanda and Raffaele, they instead just brought Rudy into the theory. And they kind of just replaced Patrick in that story with Rudy. And they say that he was there with Amanda and Raffaele when Meredith was killed on November 1st. Rudy claimed after first being arrested that he was there in the apartment that night and that he did have sex with Meredith. But he claims that after he left the room to go to the bathroom, he heard Meredith scream from her room and that another unknown person had killed her. He says that he ran out of the bathroom and saw a shadowy figure standing over Meredith's bloody body with a knife. And then he claims that the person who killed her said in perfect Italian, I've seen a couple different things. One is like, found black man, found culprit, let's go. Another source I saw said that it was, quote, black man found, black man condemned, end quote. But either way, he's basically saying like this person said that, oh, I found this guy who I'm going to pin this murder on. So he claims that he was in the bathroom with his headphones on when he heard the screams. And I guess he's saying like the feces that were found in the toilet the next day by Amanda were his and that I guess he didn't get a chance to flush before he ran out of the bathroom. So I guess that's where that goes into the story. So, and also it's weird, like he didn't call the police or anything and instead just leaves the scene and flees the country. Like to me, that's like definitely not a story that can be believed on any level. If that was a true story and a true account, why would he not just call the police and say this is what happened rather than fleeing the country right away?
What I don't understand is they have Rudy and all of his DNA and it matches the crime scene and whatever, but they have no DNA of Amanda and Raphael. And it's like, there's not really anything connecting them to the crime besides their false confession. But I'm just like, to me, like, just let them go. Like, they're not involved, but instead you're just going to replace one person with another and have all three of them. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, also I think as we started talking about this a bit more as well, they, like the pride or whatever that the prosecutor had, because his original story was that there was, or it comes up, or his story is that there's three people and he is determined that Amanda and Raffaele were involved and he doesn't want to admit that he's wrong. And so I feel like he just has to keep that story alive because for whatever reason, he just can't admit that he was wrong about it. And so he's going to do whatever he can to keep that narrative alive, just to show that he was right the entire time. Like, that's very much, like, the sense you get from him, from his interviews even. Like, he's very arrogant and just like, I was right and I'm still right. And still doesn't admit that he's wrong. So he had it in his head and he was not going to let it go.
And also,
I've seen like other reports that Rudy said he ran back into Meredith's room and he, you know, she was still alive and she was like propping herself up on him and he was covered in her blood and yet he just still left and didn't call anybody. Like, that just seems very strange. Even if you're scared, you'd think you'd still call the police if she was still alive. Why just leave her there and run? So it definitely doesn't look good for Rudy.
It also goes back to like the whole like prosecution and investigator, like how they're the same people. Like we said it earlier, it's like he doesn't want to admit that he was wrong because he's a prosecutor and he's an investigator. Like, I still think that those two things should not be the same people.
Yeah, it was like his crime scene, his evidence, and now he's presenting, you know, what he found. And if he had to admit that he was wrong, then he'd be like, he'd have to admit that he fucked up the investigation, which he's not willing to do.
But isn't it just better to admit that you fucked up the investigation, like, in that first couple weeks, and then, oh, sorry, we thought it was Patrick, and now it's this other guy, rather than just keep the story going for decades and being like, oh, no, I'm still sticking to my story. Like, that makes you look even stupider and more corrupt.
No, I know. It's weird. Yeah, and I've also seen sources where it was like, the main goal, like, the prosecution wanted to find who did it and arrest them really quickly because they had so much pressure from the media. And it's ironic because they did find someone really quickly and they did get this person arrested and convicted very quickly. Yet that wasn't enough for them. They still had to keep going. So it did become like this whole media circus where they actually did, you know, their goal was completed. They did find the murderer and get him in jail quickly, but they still had to keep going. So it just turned into a crazy string of events. Rudy had even originally said that Amanda had nothing to do with it in his confession. So he said Amanda has nothing to do with the murder and that she wasn't even there that night. But as the police continued to question him, his story gradually changed to involve Amanda, likely due to the police's pressure on him. But why were the police so focused on Amanda? Like we were saying, I think it's because that was their original theory, didn't want to admit they were wrong. But like, how do they get to that theory? And one of the things that comes up in the 48-hour podcast episode. Additionally, there's some sources that say there was evidence and a witness that came forward in the beginning that could back up the theory that there was more than one person involved. And so this might have been one of the things that like put that initial seed in their mind that it wasn't just one murderer, there was multiple people there. And so one of the neighbors of Meredith and Amanda was a woman named Nara Capizzali. And she came forward to say that on the night of the murder, she heard a blood-curdling scream coming from Meredith's house. And the Daily Mail reports, she said, quote, "I went to bed around 9 to 9:30 as there was nothing on the TV, and I woke up around 2 hours later to go to the bathroom. On my way, I passed by the window and heard a scream, not a normal scream, but a prolonged scream. It made my skin crawl. I didn't know what was happening. I looked out the window but didn't see anything. Then, a few minutes later, I heard running on the metal staircase and then running through the leaves, going in the other direction. It was at least two people. The scream left me really disturbed. Even now, it troubles me. It was a woman's scream. There was no call for help. It was just a scream, then nothing." End quote. But it's not reported that she ever called the police after this, and I'm assuming she didn't call the police because there's no reports ever saying that the police came that night, and obviously if they did, they would have, you know, found the scene at Meredith's house. And in the Case File podcast, they say that she did not call the police. But when she was cross-examined at the trial, Nara actually admits that she couldn't be sure exactly what night she heard that scream. So maybe she did hear a scream, but she's not sure if it was actually that night. So we don't even know if that was Meredith. Could have been somebody else. And there's also other sources that say that her house was actually too far away from Meredith's house anyway. So if Meredith did scream, there's no way she would have heard it anyway. So there's just like conflicting reports about what actually happened or even if anything did happen with Nara that night. And also the fact that there were two slices to Meredith's neck made the investigators think that there were two different knives had been used, and so they thought there was two different people, two different perpetrators using those knives on Meredith. And also they say because they didn't find any evidence under Meredith's nails, like she didn't scratch anybody or claw at her attacker, that made them believe that there had to be more than one person because someone had to hold her down while the other one was assaulting and stabbing her. And so that's just kind of a brief summary of why they think there was more than one person there that night and why they were not just satisfied with having Rudy go down for this murder.
Yeah, like I did see, I think it was part of the documentary I watched, but it was something where they said Meredith was like trained in karate or self-defense. So they thought like she would put up a significant fight, which means that it's likely there was more than one person. Well, that's what the prosecution is saying. And that's their theory. I don't know the legitimacy to that. Obviously, I don't believe anything the prosecution says or the police say in any way. Also, like while all this was happening with Rudy Gaudet, and he was, you know, now found with his DNA to be at the crime scene and involved, the police had found a knife at Raffaele's apartment, and they believed this knife to be the murder weapon. The only reason that I can see why they would say it was that knife was because they did have DNA evidence that they said they found that had Amanda's DNA on the handle of the knife and a small, very small trace of Meredith's DNA on the blade of the knife. So with these two pieces of DNA, that was enough to make them confident that this was the murder weapon that was used to kill Meredith. Obviously, there's issues with that, which we'll get into later. Also, another thing that came up in the investigation. So upon searching the crime scene, 46 days after Meredith was killed, they found Meredith's bra clasp in the bedroom underneath a mat. So I guess it had just not been found for the 46 days, whether it was planted there, whether it was just overlooked. For whatever reason, they didn't find that, the bra clasp, until 46 days after. And, you know, there's lots of people going in and out of the crime scene and all of that sort of stuff. They inspect the clasp and they test it and determine that Raffaele's DNA is on the bra clasp along with two other unknown males. So this was another thing that said, oh, the DNA proves that Raffaele was in that bedroom. He was there. But because of the amount of time between the murder and when it was found, and also the high chance of contamination just with the people who they weren't very experienced, they could have made a lot of mistakes. And so there was a high chance for contamination. So they do believe, and they were going in and out between Raffaele's apartment as he was arrested. He was a suspect. They were going back and forth between his house and the crime scene. So there is a high chance that they're touching things without gloves or just something happened. So they do get that contamination, or it's just blatantly planted on the bra clasp. I don't really know. But there's also two other unknown males' DNA on the clasp as well, which could also be from police officers as they're handling the evidence. Like, who really knows? So this is enough to bolster the prosecution's case that Raffaele was involved in the murder along with Amanda. However, like I said, this critical piece of evidence was highly controversial because it was either tampered with or accidentally contaminated. And also, why did they go 46 days without finding it? Like, if it's in the same bedroom, yes, it's under a mat, but if you're going to be doing a thorough search of the crime scene, that's not something that should just be overlooked and not found for 46 days. So highly suspicious that that was not found for 46 days. And that was the one piece of DNA evidence that tied Raffaele to the crime scene. And the knife, which had Amanda's DNA on the handle, was something that tied her to the crime scene. Because obviously, the thing is, like, Amanda's DNA is going to be at the scene or at the house because she lived there. So you can't really say that, oh, because Amanda's DNA is in the house, like, that's not enough, because everyone knew that she lived there. So they needed something more. So I guess this knife that was at Raffaele's apartment that had her DNA, but she also was at Raffaele's apartment. So, but it was Meredith's DNA on the blade at Raffaele's apartment that was really the clincher for them. However, the DNA trace was so small on the blade that it's a high chance it was contaminated as well, because of the kind of going back and forth between the crime scene. And also, Amanda brings up a really good point in her interview with Megyn Kelly. She says that the knife that they found was at Raffaele's apartment. So if the murder happened at Amanda's apartment and that knife is at Raffaele's, then you would have to believe that Amanda is carrying the knife between the two apartments. And yes, it's only a 5-minute walk, but that's just really weird. And also, she says that one of the main things in the prosecution, sort of their theory at trial, was that it was not a premeditated murder, that it was something that happened in the heat of the moment, like during this crazy sex game gone wrong, that Raffaele and Amanda killed her, or that she died accidentally and they covered up or whatever. If you're saying that it was not a premeditated thing, then how do you explain having the murder weapon get to Raffaele's apartment, her carrying it over there before? I guess you could say that she carried it back to his apartment after the murder, if it was originally from her apartment. So all of that sort of thing. And also the blade of the knife that they said had her and Meredith's DNA on it did not match Meredith's stab wounds on her body. So she also says, Amanda says, in order to believe that was the murder weapon, that the person who killed Meredith, if it was Amanda, would have had to like half stab Meredith. So you couldn't put the blade in the whole way because that didn't match. You would have to like half stab her to make it fit. So just a lot of inconsistencies. So those are all really good points that Amanda brings up that just shows that it's a really loose kind of theory. And they're kind of contradicting themselves if they say it's not premeditated, but then she's like transporting this huge kitchen knife between apartments. Like, to me, that's just super unrealistic and just shaky at the very least.
And also another thing, they only find Raffaele's DNA on that one bra clasp, and they don't really find much of it anywhere else. Like, how do you explain that? Like, you think if he was in that room holding her down, you know, trying to have the sex game, then there'd be, his DNA would be everywhere, right? You can't just like clean up a crime scene and only clean up your DNA but have everybody else's everywhere. Like, that doesn't make sense. So I have seen other reports that it was just, yeah, it was shoddy investigative work. Like, they were just like rummaging through stuff, and then they would find a piece of evidence, and then with their gloves that they had already touched everything with, they would touch this evidence. So it was definitely contaminated, and they just did a really shitty job. So yeah, just wanted to stick that in there.
Yeah. And it's just like very unlikely that you're going to only have Raffaele's DNA on one little piece of evidence and not anywhere else if he was involved. And also how convenient that it's just one piece. It's like, because all you need is one piece to prove someone was there, but if it's tampered with or planted there, like, it's kind of also suspicious. It's just one piece. Like, that's really, really sketchy.
Yeah, it should be all over the place. I can't just clean up your own DNA, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, and then the police were also, and the media were also trying to paint this picture. I guess it came out, or this head investigator guy, McNeeny, says that they also had proof of receipts that Amanda had bought bleach shortly after the murder, and that she had gone back to the apartment and cleaned the apartment with bleach, but somehow left only Rudy Gadet's DNA and that one piece of Raffaele's DNA, like, cleared her, all of her. Like, it's just totally unrealistic. And then they never did end up producing any proof of receipts that there was any bleach bought.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they went in and cleaned up all their own DNA, but left Rudy's. Like, that makes zero sense. Also, I heard that they had smelled bleach in Raffaele's apartment, as if they had cleaned up his apartment really thoroughly in a couple days following the murder. So, I mean, there's just like these stories everywhere. And I mean, what's the crime of cleaning up your fucking house if it's scuzzy, right? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you can also see police photos of like when they first went into the crime scene. Like, it doesn't look like a scene that's been cleaned up in any sense. Like, if someone cleaned the apartment with the bleach, it's going to be looking a lot. Like, it just, you can just tell. It's just not freshly wiped clean with bleach, with the exception of the crime, the room itself. I don't know. It's just, like, very, very shaky evidence. So, like, the knife was a big thing in this case because it was, like, how did it get to Raffaele's apartment? Why was the DNA there? But it can be proven and, like, kind of pretty obvious that it was contaminated as well as the bra clasp as well. So just a lot of super sketchy things. Also, I had a question that I was thinking of. This isn't related to the knife or the bra clasp, but I was just thinking of this. We said in the first part that it was probably Philomena's room that was broken into with the window. So, like, Meredith's window wasn't broken into. So how did the person who did it get out of the room? They locked it from the inside. Like, because they had to break down the door to get in. So obviously you can't lock or unlock it from the outside. It has to be from the inside. So, like, how did the person who did it get out and then lock the door behind them but didn't go out the broken window? I guess they could just go out the window normally.
In some of the research that I was doing, there was some reports that someone had stolen Meredith's keys. I guess her purse had been rummaged through. So like we said, her cell phone was missing. I guess she had money in her wallet that was missing. She had rent money that they had proved that she had taken out of the bank, but she hadn't given to the landlord yet. And that money wasn't found. So they think that someone stole her money. And also they think that they took her keys, locked her bedroom door with those keys, and then ran out the front door and left that open. So that's maybe an explanation, but yeah.
That makes a little bit more sense. Because before I was thinking, like, how did this person get even out of the room if it's locked from the
Before Katie said that, that's what I was thinking. Like, you can't just not get out of a room when it's locked from the inside. But it makes more sense if it was locked from the outside.
Yeah, it kind of seems like an old-fashioned thing to have a lock for a bedroom door with an actual key. But that's the research that I found. Anyway.
Well, it's also Europe. Like, it's Italy, and they have, like, older, like, architecture and houses. And, like, they probably do have flats with, like, with old style doors where you would have like a traditional lock.
That's true. And also I think maybe it makes sense because it's like roommates and they each have their own room to kind of keep their own stuff secure. They could have a lock that only they could open. That makes sense too.
I was also thinking like a lot of apartments around here, like where I live or in Canada, like a lot of apartments don't have locks on their bedroom doors. Am I correct? Or is that just something I've noticed or... That's not everywhere.
Well, I think newer things, like places don't have like a key for their bedroom door, but maybe in a place where it's like meant to be an apartment and like shared space, you would want to have a lock for your own door. Maybe that's what it was. And like AJ said, it's Europe, so those places are old usually.
Like a lot of like doors open with like traditional keys. So that's not that weird, I guess, but. What do you guys think of, like, the fact that the bra clasp was found 46 days after and also the knife that was found at Raffaele's apartment? Like, clearly staged, right?
Yeah, I feel like the knife definitely staged. Like, I don't understand why it would even be at his apartment. Like, somebody obviously put that there to make it seem like he had something to do with it because the knife being at his apartment just doesn't make any sense. And obviously, they didn't do a big enough search in the like first initial day that they did searches, or they would have found the bra clasp. Like 46 days later seems way too long for something to be found like that, especially something that significant.
Yeah, so for me, I don't think things were like staged or planted. I think the knife, the explanation that it actually was Raffaele's and it was just contaminated. Like I think they just did a shitty job handling evidence and maybe even just in the lab, things got contaminated. I don't necessarily think they planted that there. And for the bra clasp, yeah, again, I think they just weren't finding evidence that Raffaele was involved. And so they were just searching and they finally found this other piece and then it got contaminated as well. Like, I don't think it was intentionally staged. I just think it was just mishandling for sure. And then they were like, oh, like it actually happened to have a trace amount because it wasn't handled properly. And they ran with that. But yeah, 46 days later, it does seem very extreme. Like, I don't think they were in there for 46 days straight searching for stuff. Because if they were, they didn't find it, then they were working very slowly, I feel. But yeah, I just think it was mishandled. And I don't think it was necessarily planted there purposely.
And it's just like very thin evidence. Like the only thing that ties Raffaele's apartment to Meredith is like her small amount of DNA on the blade that in his apartment. And then his DNA on the bra clasp like ties him to the crime scene. So just like one very thin layer. And obviously, like I said before, Amanda's DNA is going to be all over that place because she lived there. So one of the other evidence that's found in the case included, it said, one of the documentaries said it included Amanda's DNA mixed with Meredith's in several blood stains that were found in the bathroom sink. I mean, I guess, like I said, Amanda lived there, so her DNA being in the sink wouldn't be weird, but I guess maybe the way it was mixed in. But again, if it's, they're not very experienced and like there's tampering or there's cross-contamination, like I don't find that really to be that believable, really. I don't know, I guess, the in-depth details of like how her DNA was mixed in, but maybe if her Meredith's blood was in the sink and then Amanda's had been in there prior just from living there, they somehow get mixed in that way. Another thing in this case that's pretty crazy, I think, too, is Amanda and Raffaele had been arrested and they were both kept in jail for almost 8 months before they were even charged with Meredith's murder. So in Italy, you actually can be arrested by the police for a crime and held in custody while the investigation is going on without even being formally charged, which is obviously a drastic difference from in here in Canada and then in the US. Like, I think in Canada and the US, like, there's a certain amount of time. I think it's like 48 hours or 72 hours or something where you can be in custody before you have to be charged. And then if you aren't charged, they have to release you. So it's pretty crazy that they were in jail for the entire 8 months for the bulk of this investigation. And then if at the end it came out that they were cleared, like they would have been sitting in jail for 8 months while they did the investigation. So that just seems like a botched way to do it just from the get-go. So they both were eventually officially charged. for Meredith's murder on July 11th of 2008, 8 months after they were initially arrested. So by the summer of 08, the police feel confident based on all these little pieces of evidence we mentioned that they can be charged. And then in September of 2008, Rudy Gaday, he actually requests a speedy trial because he was arrested for her murder as well. And there was fear by him and his legal team that if he did not get a speedy or a separate trial, that Amanda and Raffaele would both kind of collude with each other to put the blame totally on him for the murder, and that he would get the maximum sentence and maybe they would get off scot-free. Like maybe the two of them would have striked a deal to put the blame mostly on him. So he wanted to do a speedy trial to just prevent that possibility before they had a chance to really, you know, collude with each other, I guess. So with the speedy trial also comes the prospect of a reduced sentence, likely an attractive option for Rudy and his lawyer as well.
Yeah, and so Rudy actually is found guilty of Meredith's murder, and he's originally sentenced to 30 years in prison, but he does have a successful appeal, and his sentence is reduced to only 16 years.
And so Rudy Gaday was actually tried and sentenced before Amanda and Raffaele even began their trials. So because he got the speedy trial, he was kind of in and out and got that 30 years, which was then reduced to 16. And so by the time Amanda and Raphael begin their trials, Rudy Gaday has already been sentenced and it's been deemed that he was there. He was involved, but Amanda and Raffaele are not off the hook and their trials begin in January of 2009. So that's where we're going to end this part. And do you, either of you kind of have any final thoughts about what we've covered in this part?
It's just crazy to me how like Rudy was convicted of the crime, but yet Amanda and Raphael are still like strung along as like people who could have helped him do the crime. So it's just unfortunate like they had to spend all that time in jail for something they didn't do and their lives were changed forever just because of the police just wanting them to be a part of something they weren't.
Yeah, I think it's crazy that even Rudy himself said that Amanda wasn't there, wasn't involved. And even though Amanda confessed and then recanted, said she wasn't involved and said Patrick wasn't involved and it was proved that Patrick wasn't involved, like how many times do you have to be proved that someone saying that you weren't there for it to actually stick? So it's kind of crazy. And also them being in jail during the investigation is crazy. Like that's so different than here because, yeah, like you said, you can't be charged with something and in jail unless you actually have evidence of it so you can be arrested. So that's super shocking.
Yeah, it's crazy that they let Patrick, like, after he was in jail for 2 weeks, they let him off because somebody corroborated that he had an alibi and it was true. But then, like, when Rudy Gaday says himself that Amanda wasn't there because he was talking to a friend and they had that recording that's saying, admitting Amanda wasn't there, but that's not enough to get her off, but it was enough for them to let Patrick off. For like a similar thing.
I know. Yeah. So, yeah, when Amanda said that after she had signed that confession, it was like 100% over for her. And like, it really was because they were not going to forgive her for that. So it's super unfortunate.
Yeah. Like, and it's like just weird that it's like you have a man who was there and has proven to be there saying that she wasn't there, but that's still not enough. Like, it's just totally crazy. And I guess if they had just like waited a minute at the very beginning before putting it all on Amanda, like if they had just waited like a couple of weeks without doing all that stuff, then they wouldn't have to then try to like keep that story going just to cover their own tracks. Like if they just cooled it for a second, they would have like, oh, and by the time December rolls around, they already have Rudy Gaday and that could have been it. But because they had to keep up the charade of like, no, our original theory was right too.
Yeah, they wouldn't have had to backtrack and be like, oh no, we were wrong. They could have, if they would have just like held on for a second, and they would never have to have been like, oh, we were wrong. They wouldn't have put it out there in the first place that Amanda was involved. So, yeah, they just got, it was the media pressure. They just got too fucking hyper and excited that they had gotten all these people. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just totally, totally crazy. So that's where we're going to end it for this part. So in the next part, we're going to go more into detail about Amanda and Raffaele's trials. And, you know, it's kind of a crazy series of events from like a trial and then like a retrial and then all of this other stuff. I don't want to give it too much away in case you don't know all about the case, but it's a kind of a wild ride from what happens next. It's pretty crazy. So that's kind of the stuff we're going to get into in the next part. So tune in next week for part 3. We hope you enjoyed part 2. And I hope you're enjoying our deep dive of the Meredith Kircher murder case. So you can follow us on all the social medias. As always, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Crime Family Podcast. We're on X at Crime Family Pod 1. You can get merch for the show and support the show if you would like. We have the link to that in the show notes. We also have the link to our Patreon page. So if you want to be a patron and get early access to the episodes before everyone else, also ad-free content, and as well as bonus episodes throughout the season, that's all available on our Patreon if you are a paid member. So the link to that's in the show notes. And we also have our YouTube channel. So all of our episodes are on YouTube. So you can follow us, Crime Family Podcast, subscribe, engage with us in the comments section, leave your feedback, leave us a review on the app that you listen to the show. We'd love to hear what you think of the show, and any feedback you have would be great. We also have an email. You can email us at crimefamilypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts or suggestions. So definitely keep your feedback coming. And like I said, review us, give us a review, give us a rating. We like to hear all that stuff. So thank you so much. We hope you're enjoying our coverage of this case, and we'll be back next week with part 3. So until then, thank you so much and take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.